You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1981 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fifth class in a series given by Brother Norm Zillmer on the subject, Paul's Letter to the Romans.
I don't know how the other teachers feel, but it's a real scramble of the last day to try to put things together, for this teacher anyway. There is so much, and we wish we had the time for it, and we don't. Would like to share with you one thing that we didn't do earlier this week that might be helpful just as we begin. I'm not sure where it best would fit if we were to put it into our notes, but we'll give it to you now. When the Apostle Paul writes his letter to Rome, we have indicated how great a Bible study he was engaged in. And a lot of that was from memory, as we sort of implied the other day, because he had such long parchments to go through in order to find all of those verses. But everything that he did was in one framework. Everything that he had to say was within a single, rather large, but limited framework. And that was Bible alone. Through the Bible alone, he was acquiring some hope of something. There was no other resource that he had. It was the framework within which he moved and within which we move as well. And within that framework, there's another great principle which fills a very large space too, and that is Christ alone. It is through Christ only that there is hope of salvation. And you saw when we discussed in the very first session how Jesus was his hero, his ideal, and his master. It is always through Christ alone that anything comes. That's a settled source, a truth on which others are founded. And within that framework, there are two others that the apostle discusses, and which we have discussed during this week. One moves from God to man, and it is by grace alone. And the other one moves from man toward God, and it is by faith alone. So when somebody says it's by grace alone that we are saved, that's right, and it's within the framework of these other two things. And when someone says, it's not our works which are doing the thing for us, that's right too. But it's within the framework of these other things as well. So we have a settled principle of the Bible alone as our resource, of Christ alone as the means of salvation, of grace alone which is able to save us, and of faith alone which is able to be the response that we bring to God as we begin living our lives. And of course, as you remember, we had in our breakdown of what faith involved, it had our intellect and our will and our emotions and our conscience and our sense of worship, all involved within it, which made up then the sum total of what faith is. So that it's not just an intellectual agreement that we sit here and say, oh, that's great. All I need is faith, and then I can be assured of an eternal hope. It involves a great deal, and that's what Romans 12 is about, is how does the faith work out then in the manner of living so that we can present our bodies to God as our reasonable worship or our spiritual worship. So I thought that might be helpful to you to kind of explore that particular point, and to sort of see how all of this is fitting together, because this is really what Paul is talking about in the whole book of Romans, is much this kind of a fitting together. And then when he comes to the end part, he sort of expands the section that has to do with faith alone and spreads it out and says, and as a result of all the rest that we've talked about up to this point, now what ought we to be doing with our lives? And there's a great deal that we are supposed to be doing. We only managed to get through about half of chapter 12 yesterday, and I'd love to spend the time on the rest of it today, but I think maybe we might just take a couple of glances at it and then go on from there. The first thing that
we talked about was the inward looking, followed then by the service, and that the fact that, as Brother Marco has been bringing out to us during this week in the adult class, we are our brother's keeper, and it is important for us to employ these gifts for the benefit of others. I'm going to be treading rather heavily with my large boots, I fear, if it's fair to say I fear, on Brother Marco's territory today, and if I have said some things which he will then be following up with later in the third period, I might apologize, but I think what I probably would rather say is then we shall simply reinforce more dramatically the things that we both are trying to say about this kind of thing. Okay, all of these gifts that the apostle has been talking about, of prophecy or forth-telling, of service, of teaching, of exhortation, of contribution, and all of that, has to be applied to our relationship to a very important concept which runs through the New Testament. Anybody need this anymore? And it is found so often that it almost deserves to be a theme for our lives. The theme is that of one another. At least 60 times that I've been able to find in the New Testament, this theme of one another is found in the New Testament. And 10 of those 60 are found here in the book of Romans. And they begin in chapter 12, because of course he has dealt with his doctrinal material, his teaching material, prior to getting to chapter 12, and now he begins to lay out this exhortation, and one of the principal themes that comes out of that is the matter of one another. You remember that he wrote this to commend Jews to Gentiles and Gentiles to Jews, and so this is a very important part. And now he's able to come down hard upon this particular matter. Seeing that all of these other things are so, you ought to remember, verse 5, that we are individually members one of another. That is the principal and underlying truth about one another that we must know. We are members of one another, Romans 12, 5. And then, in verse 9, comes the next one. Pardon me, verse 10 comes the next one. Love one another with brotherly affection. Marshall's translation puts it, in brotherly love to one another, loving warmly. So it just emphasizes warm love that comes to one another. And the latter part of that verse says, in RSV, outdo one another in showing honor. So if we are members of one another and we love one another, then we outdo one another in showing honor to the other fellow, not to ourselves, obviously. Then in verse 16, live in harmony with one another. And again, we have the idea of not just a matter of not confronting one another. That is to say, well, I don't agree with that, brother, but I won't bring it up for the sake of peace. It is active harmony that is involved. Do you remember the Old Testament word shalom? And what does shalom mean? Peace, yes. But is peace just the absence of hostility? No. The peace which is the kingdom kind of peace that God has in mind, that really embraces the whole sense of the term shalom, is active harmony. You remember we've heard it quoted several times during this week, that peace involves, in the kingdom age, the fact that carnivorous animals can be led by a child, that a child can put his hand on the serpent's den, that there is no harmfulness, that all of creation is at harmony with the rest of God's work. And that's the kind of thing that the apostle is admonishing us to cultivate now, so that we're ready for that time of harmony when it comes. Live in harmony with one another. The next place he mentions it is in chapter 13 at verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love one another. He keeps on going on that subject of love. Christian love, whether it's exercised toward the brethren or toward anybody, toward men generally, is not just an impulse from our feelings. You know, feelings come and go. Feelings are not something that are very reliable. If I only show any affection to you when my feelings tell me to do so, you might think I was a cold person. Because it's hard for any one of us to always feel loving. The kind of love that is always in mind in the New Testament is that ability to love the unlovable. To love people even when they're being unlovable. How about our children, you know, those of us who are parents? When our kid is being grouchy and just a holy terror, do we quit loving them? I hope not. But they're being very unlovable sometimes, aren't they? I can remember my two, boy, just if you'd followed your feelings, I'd have loved to haul off and whack them. Because they were being so unlovable. And the Christian love that we are called to is to love that which is the unlovable. It doesn't always run with our natural inclinations, nor does this kind of love spend itself only on those people who are part of our family, for which some affinity has been found. Love rather seeks the welfare of all and works no ill to any. Love seeks the opportunity, as Paul says in Galatians 6:10, to do good to all men, and especially to them who are of the household of the faith. So there are at least five of those one another types of things. When we get to chapter 14, he talks again in the 13th verse about this, and now he's talking about a negative side of this. Let us no more pass judgment on one another. The word that is there translated past judgment is krino in the Greek, which means to assume the office of a judge, the one who sits there with the gavel in his hand. Does any of you have a gavel? Does any of you feel qualified to sit in the court of God and pass judgment on His behalf? I don't think we ever think of ourselves in that kind of category, do we? That's a presumption that none of us would accrue to himself. And yet we do it, don't we? We say about that brother, he's inadequate. And that, of course, means that I am perfectly adequate and able to decide that. We say, he's not doing the right thing. And that means, of course, that I am doing the right things, and I always do that, and I'm therefore in the position to judge whether he does the right thing or not. Now, I'm saying about judging, not about discerning between those things which God has established as a thou shalt not, or thou shalt, or a thus saith the Lord. When we have those things involved, we're dealing with matters of discerning good and evil. It's a different thing from passing judgment. Passing judgment is running around and saying, I know what that fellow ought to be doing, and he's not doing it. Look how the apostle deals with that in chapter 14 at the first part of that verse. He talks about two classes of people, and there really are only two. One who is weak in faith, and one who is a liberal. I think we could call them the legalist and the liberal. And he's talking about the food prejudices of the Jews versus the Gentile liberality of eating first instance. But it fits with other things as well, which is why he sort of generalizes it. So he says in verse 3, let not him who eats, that would be the Gentile in this instance, despise him who abstains, and let not him who abstains, which would be the Jew in this case, pass judgment on him who eats, for God has welcomed him. And here he has set before us the two pitfalls that we have. You know, the Gentile says, who is a true Jew? He's not a true Jew who is one outwardly. Paul has said that. But the circumcision is of the heart. So I'm the true Jew, says the Gentile. And the Jew says, not so. I'm the true Jew and the child of Abraham. We get this kind of argument that goes on, and we have it in our community presently. Who's a true Jew? Who's the right one? Who's got the right statement of faith? Who's got the right attitude toward divorce and remarriage? Who's got the right attitude about 1,001 things that we find to conflict about amongst ourselves from time to time? We might as well face the fact that we do that. Which one of us is the true Jew? And he says there are two things that we have as pitfalls. One is to despise, and the other is to pass judgment. And he says you have no business to do either one. He says in verse 4, it is before his own master that he stands or falls. and he will be upheld. For the Master is able to make him stand. We may not think he's able to stand, but is there any one of us who can stand before the Master without grace? None of the things that we are able to do in our lives is adequate. It is only through God's grace extended downward to us that we have any hope at all, of any kind, for anything, because every one of us is inadequate, insufficient, failing, and foolish. That's what Paul has said back in the third chapter. He introduced that theme. There is no one who does righteously, not one. Now, when we're all in that kind of category, which one of us is ready to cast the first stone at someone else? Jesus says you can't do that. And it's that is one of the larger problems, I think, it's at times, within our brotherhood. And I think God is giving us, in this last time, a sort of last chance for us to get our act together at a time when we very, very well may need each other. If the time of tribulation and difficulty comes that seems to be indicated in some of the scriptures that we read, in the Mount Olivet prophecy and in Revelation, then maybe we really ought to get ourselves together, but because we're going to need each other sorely. Very well. In chapter 15, then, and verses 1 and 2, are established a few things that, as a result of this kind of thinking, we must understand. Paul is written, he says, a little later in this chapter, very boldly, in the way of reminder, because of the grace given to him as a minister of Christ. And so he's told them in rather sharp terms about the fact they have no business being like some of them apparently are. The alternative then is to be in our activities, verse 15, chapter 15, verse 1, we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of the not strong. That's how it reads more or less literally in the Greek. We who are strong ought to bear the failings of the not strong and not to please ourselves. Now I'd like to share with you something about that bearing the not strong, bearing the weaknesses of others. Back in Matthew, the 16th chapter, we've talked about Jesus all week in some ways, and yet we've referred to him very little in this particular class, because we had so much to talk about that we couldn't spend a lot of time on everything at the same time. But I think it's important for us to investigate this particular thing. Matthew 16:24. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." I emphasize the ends because they're there and they really are three kinds of things that are being told. Deny oneself and take up his cross and follow me. The first thing that the Master asks of his disciples, those who are the faithful followers who will in fact follow him to death, is to deny themselves. I must do precisely what Peter did when he denied his Lord. I must say, "I know not this man." Right? That's what denying oneself is. I know not this man. That's a very large order. But the call to discipleship and baptism in the name of Jesus Christ, as we've seen in Romans 6, means both death and life. And he says, whoever, verse 25, would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. There is something about this that's more than just baptism. It involves a constant dying. That's what the Apostle Paul said. I die daily. And I think that's what we have to do. We crucify this fellow every day, myself. That's part of our work that we do in the discipleship of Christ. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, and take up his cross. Now I want you to think for a minute of what it would have been like to live in that period of time and hear somebody say something about taking up crosses. You know, crosses nowadays are the things that adorn the top of steeples or that perhaps are worn as an ornament around the neck. It wasn't something so trivial or so abstract as that that the apostles would have understood when the Master said that to them. In the Roman world of the first century, a man who was carrying a cross knew that he was about to die. Nobody carried crosses except to a crucifixion. So when Jesus said this, it had a lot more force than just something, we follow in Jesus' path. It means he's going to do something that might cause his death. And Thomas, whom we remember, sadly enough, only for his doubting, let's remember him for another thing that he did. John 11:16 says, when he was one of those, when Jesus was determined he was going to go to Judea, in spite of the fact that the Jews were seeking him and were about to kill him, and they tried to dissuade him at the time that Jesus was going to raise Lazarus, Thomas, mind you, was the one who said, "Let us also go that we may die with him." And he was willing to go with the Master and to die with him if necessary. I think that's an example of how Thomas was taking up his cross in that kind of way. It's a voluntary acceptance of the fact that we are on a path that has led our Master to death, and if the world has hated him, then it's likely to hate us. And we may have to, in fact, bear some things. There must be a voluntary acceptance of that cross-bearing. Now, I want us to not think so sentimentally about cross-bearing that somehow we come to the point where we think our cross-bearing is the same as his. After all, it is not we who have died on behalf of sin. It was his sacrifice, which is the perfect one to save. Yet there is another sense in which our cross-bearing shares a similarity to his, because we bear, as part of our cross-bearing, the burdens of others. Colossians 1:24, in the modern language version, and I'll cause a smile to come across the faces of the Mackenzies who are reading from that one in their parallel Bibles. Colossians 1:24 there, which I think has captured the best in that version, Modern Language Bible, that I've seen so far, the thought of the Apostle Paul says this: "I am now glad amid my sufferings for you, and am making up in my own life, on behalf of his body, which is the church, what I am still lacking of afflictions for Christ." So the Apostle feels that part of his discipleship involves bearing the burdens of others, even if it involves some suffering on behalf of others. And one of my favorite Old Testament characters, Jeremiah, says in one of those little prayers which he intersperses amongst his messages, where he just pours out his deepest feelings, and we get to see the inward workings of the man as well as the message that he's bringing. In chapter 4 of Jeremiah at verse 19, after God has said, "Your ways and your doings have brought this upon you. This is your doom, and it is bitter. It has reached your very heart." Then Jeremiah breaks in with his own cry of pain on behalf of his people whom he has to bring this message to. And he says, my anguish, I writhe in pain. Oh, the walls of my heart is beating wildly. I cannot keep silent, for I hear the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Disaster follows hard on disaster. The whole land is laid waste. Suddenly my tents are destroyed, my curtains in a moment. How long must I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? And he's weeping on behalf of others. The burden which he must bring to them, he doesn't bring to them saying, "Aha, and you've brought this all on yourself, you realize." He comes and he says, "Oh, I'm so sad that it has to be this way," because he's bearing the burden of other people. Now it's that, I submit to you, that the Apostle Paul is talking about in Romans 15:1. We, if we are strong, ought to bear the weaknesses of the not strong. And is there any one of us who's not part iron and part clay? Every one of us has the same problem, do we not? We may be strong in one thing and weak in another. We may be strong in one thing one day and weak in the same thing on another day. Right? We've all experienced that kind of thing. Some days it's easy to get out of bed in the morning and to come to class. Other days, oh boy, is it tough. And it's the same person. And we need somebody to come along and encourage us sometimes when the days are tough. Not just for coming to class or something small as that, but maybe our work situation or our family situation or whatever else has burdened us to the point where we need a time of encouragement. It is then that we need a sensitive brother or sister to be able to say to us, can I help? And to see the need and to fill it. We talked about that yesterday, not just to do what we'd like to do because it happens to be our favorite occupation, but rather to do the thing that needs to be done. Okay, the third thing that Jesus said in Matthew 16 was, and follow me. I should like to take you to Luke 6, verse 40, which you may or may not want to look up, but just suit yourselves. Very brief, Luke 6, 40 says, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully taught, will be like his teacher. Can you see then a progression here in what the Master has asked of us? Everyone who wants to follow him must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And when he has fully followed his teacher, he'll be like him. He will be like his teacher. Oh, Lord Jesus, I have so far to go to be like you. We all do. But that's what we are asked to do, to be like him. And he says, everyone who doesn't do that and who doesn't lose his life on Jesus' behalf will find he loses it at the judgment. Verse 26, if we could sort of paraphrase it as a statement instead of a question in Matthew 16, says something like, there is nothing that you can offer with which to buy back your life at the judgment if you have forfeited it in the life before that. All right, now that's what the Apostle Paul is talking about. Romans 15, we'll go back to it again, we'll say it again. I hope you don't get tired of it. We who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of the not strong, not to please ourselves. Let each of us please his neighbor for his good, to edify him. And the very example he picks is, for Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproach thee fell on me. And that's part of one another. Now, the next thing that really says one another about it is in the fifth verse of chapter 15. I'd like you to think for just a second. We've done this in most of the marriages I've happened to have celebrated, and we'll do it again, God willing, in the marriage that we will be celebrating a week from tomorrow back at home. Romans 15, 5 and 6, it seems to me, are one of the best expressions of a motto for a marriage, a blessing, a benediction to be placed upon a marriage as I can find anywhere in Scripture. May the God of steadfastness and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another, in accord with Christ Jesus, that together you may with one voice glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Ah, my. I think the RSV does a commendable job of expressing that in that particular place. And I think that's one of those things. If I were a plaque maker, boy, I'd like to see one of those in everybody's house where they stuck it up on the wall and thought about it in their family living situations to where that was the thing that guided them and the principle that they could, in a brief statement, express how their lives were going to function as they together live out a life in service to our Master. Now, it was given to a family within Rome, a brotherhood, an extended family. And so I think it fits with a family. I'm sure he had it in mind in that kind of way, and it certainly fits in our personal families as well. And my wife's favorite one is in Psalm 34:3, where it says, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt His name together." And there it seems to me again is another beautiful, joyful expression of how a family living, whether it be ecclesial or individual, can find a motto. Magnify the Lord with me and let us exalt His name together. Another one another type of passage then. Okay, in verse 15, verse 7 of chapter 15, we have another of the one another's. Welcome one another. Therefore, as Christ has welcomed you for the glory of God, for I tell you that Christ became a servant to the circumcised, here's the Jew again, to show God's truthfulness in order to confirm the promises given to the patriarchs, and in order that the Gentiles might glorify God for His mercy. And once again, he's picked up this thread of Jew versus Gentile and saying it shouldn't be versus at all, it should be in harmony with each other. That you have differences in your traditions. You have differences perhaps in location because there were apparently more than one assembly that gathered together in Rome. You have differences in your attitudes and practices as a result of some of your background, and they demand then brotherly consideration and a welcoming of one another. And then he goes on in the 14th verse to say, I myself am satisfied about you, my brethren, that you yourselves are full of goodness, a moral quality, good in character and beneficial in its effect, that you are filled with all knowledge, which is that which one has come to understand by investigation and inquiry, and therefore you are able to instruct one another. And I say all of that at once because, we all would like to be able to instruct one another. We just dearly love to go about telling everybody else how they ought to run their life. It's very easy to do that. It's much harder to tell myself how to run my own life than it is, oh, well, brother, your problem is this. And once I've shown you the relevant principles that apply, we snap our Bible shut, and all you have to do is go and put them in practice, and you'll be as good as I am. We kind of do that sometimes, don't we? That's an exaggeration. But you understand that when I'm saying this, I'm speaking in an exaggerated sort of form so as to jog us out of whatever little ruts we may have got into so that we can think again and think more lovingly about the situation that each of us finds ourselves in as we relate to one another. Some of you who have read some works by J. Adams will know that at this point, Williams translation says, you are filled with knowledge and competent to counsel one another. And I think that's not a bad way of expressing this. Competent to counsel, able to warn one another, able to help one another along the road that leads to life. And we have to do that, don't we? We encourage one another as we go along. It isn't a matter of instructing them by sitting them down and telling them what's what. It's feeling with and understanding and empathizing with those people who have problems or difficulties or whose lives at this particular time seem to be torn up. And it's that we do, provided we have the goodness and the understanding that we'll bring to bear, and we bring those good qualities to our counsel. Just for a second, we'll look at Colossians 3:16 in relation to this. Colossians 3:16. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another in all wisdom. So it is not something that we just do by virtue of, oh, well, off the top of my head, I'd say this. It is rather that the word of Christ is what's bringing us the ability to teach and admonish. And then the warning is the same kind of thing that Paul talks about in Colossians 1:28. Whom he says, we warn every man, teaching every man in all wisdom, that we may present every man mature in Christ. The idea again is not to warn for the sake of saying, and if you don't do what you're supposed to do, somebody's going to cut you off, but rather warning everyone so that every man may be presented mature in Christ. As always, the will of God is reconciliation. The purpose of God ever since the Garden of Eden was prohibited from mankind's experience has been to getting back in the garden where reconciliation could take place, where full fellowship with God could be restored. Okay, then we go to Romans 16:16, and we there see the last of our one another passages. I think you begin to see how much of a thread there is in this idea that the apostle keeps hammering at. Because 10 times now in about 3 or 4 chapters he has talked about this. And he says in verse 16 of chapter 16, greet one another with a holy kiss. I don't suppose anybody knows exactly what that means in this time. We don't really know. There's no description ever given of what the first century custom was of greeting one another with a holy kiss. It certainly had to be something different from what we see heads of state do when they walk down off the ramp of the airplane and you see them sort of mechanically and perfunctorily buss each other on the cheek and embrace rather briefly, and they look so bored while they're doing that, don't they? Well, I feel certain that that has nothing to do with what the Apostle Paul is talking about. In our day and time, of course, well, we have our sisters oftentimes kiss each other, and some of our brethren do the same kind of thing. And I suppose sometimes it's even as mechanical as what we just talked about with the heads of state. Don't we? I mean, really, in all honesty, we sometimes just sort of say, oh, good morning, sister, and that's it. And we don't do anything more than that. And I'm, again, quite certain that that's not what the apostle had in mind, and I'm not trying to say that we shouldn't do that. But I am saying that we ought to invest in it more of ourselves than sometimes it seems that we do. By greeting one another with a holy kiss, in our day and time, perhaps, it is to say, how does your ankle feel this morning? And to really feel for that. I used to be one of the world's greatest ankle sprainers. I can identify with ankle sprains probably about as well as anybody in this room, I think. Because, boy, I have done it. I used to trade ankles, you might say. I'd get one just about well and the other one would get sprained, seemed like. I was always a klutz, and I freely confess before you, I just don't know how to put my 2 feet under me. So I can feel with a brother who, or another, who has an ankle sprain. And we have other kinds of situations. Some of them we've experienced ourselves, or sometimes we haven't. But we can say, I don't really understand, but I'm trying. And by God's grace, maybe together we can help to work this thing out. Because there are lots of things worse in the world than an ankle sprain or a broken bone or something like that. The kind of healing that the apostle talks about in Galatians 6:2, which resembles very much the statement made in Romans 15:1-2. It says in Galatians 6:2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. And just before that he has said, you who are spiritual, if you overtake someone in a trespass, should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Once again, the idea of God is always reconciliation, not breakup. And that I'm given to understand that that word there that is restore in the English version is the Greek word for the mending of a broken bone. So when we are involved in the healing process with our brothers or sisters, what we are supposed to be doing is to help them when they're sort of crippled spiritually, to help that healing process to take place. Now, we can't help a broken bone which is in somebody else's body by anything that we can do from an external point of view. But we can, in a spiritual way, do a lot to help one another when our bones spiritually are broken, when things are out of joint. Again, precisely that is the thought in the 12th chapter of Hebrews at verse 12. Therefore, lift the wearied hands and strengthen the weak knees. See, this is a part of the responsibility that we have as brethren and sisters to help one another in our extended family situation, in our ecclesias and in situations such as we find ourselves in here. Literally, I understand that the two words that are used there, in mine it says, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. Literally, it says, lift the wearied hands and strengthen the paralyzed knees. So it isn't just my strength that I draw by pulling myself up by my bootstraps, taking care of my life. It is, in fact, a responsibility that we bear to share with each other the things that will help the wearied and strengthen the paralyzed. Have you ever been in a situation where you're absolutely paralyzed? Spiritually speaking. You don't know which way to turn. You're lost, or you're sort of standing there and you know there are 1,000 things you ought to be doing and somehow you don't know which one to start with. That's what the apostle is talking about here when he says, that's when you can slide in there and help. And take over an obligation, do something, talk with, or help one another. It's that that has been the thing that the apostle wanted to get across since the very time that he began his message to Rome. He wants to share with them, if you look back at the first chapter, the good things that they can do to edify one another. Verse 8, we'll just begin there. It's Romans 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed in all the world. For God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of His Son, that without ceasing I mention you always in my prayers, asking that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you. That is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. It's his whole purpose that each one might be able to grow through the activities of the other. And that's love. That's the kind of love that we are called upon to live with and to live for, and to remember that our Master lived for us. I will say something now that I think you might find at first a little surprising. And then when you think about it, you'll realize that it's absolutely true. Love is the normal human relationship. Did you ever think about that? Anything less than love is abnormal in God's view. What did the law say? What did Jesus say the law said? The first two commandments. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And isn't it interesting? And I'm sure that those people who were listening were startled when he didn't pick another of the Ten Commandments. He picked one that's not even in the same record of the Ten Commandments. He picked one out of Leviticus, which is love your neighbor as yourself. And he said, on those two hang all of the law and the prophets. And when the Apostle Paul writes to Rome, as he said in the 13th chapter that we've just been considering in some brief fashion, he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. That's Romans 13:8. For he says, the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Therefore, love is the normal human relationship. And this is essential Christianity in action. This is essential Christianity in action. Love. Unconquerable benevolence, invincible goodwill, unaffected by insult or injury or grievance, and it engages not only our emotions but our will. It's a victory, in fact, over our natural instincts. Who, for instance, naturally would do what Jesus asked, to pray for your enemies? That's priesthood in action. That's love in action. A principle energized by the will of God at work within us. And then, and only then, can we say that we have met the test that Jesus says is the test of discipleship? John 13, 34 and 35. And with this we will conclude, reluctantly, I guess. John 13, 34, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And there's the test. Do all men know that we are the disciples of Christ because of our love? I thank you for this week. It's been joyous to share the fellowship with you. And if I don't get to say so during some of the time that we visit in fellowship informally, may I say to you all now, God go with you. We love you. And we've enjoyed this week immensely. Thank you.